This is your Polycast for Thursday, December 20th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, Governor Mark Dayton leaves the political stage, federal sentencing reform, and Minnesota. Minnesota's population grew last year and now tops 5.6 million people, according to new U.S. Census Bureau estimates. Brian Baxt has more.
The figures show a growth of 43,000 people between 2017 and 2018. Some of it stems from migration of people from other states, some from people coming here from abroad, and some from having more births than deaths. It's the second year of gains from domestic migration after 15 years of net population loss. The estimates give Minnesota some sense of where it stands a little more than a year out from the 2020 census. That hard count will determine whether Minnesota keeps 8 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. It's on the cusp of losing one. Brian Baxt, NPR News at the Capitol.
Governor-elect Tim Walz is expected to name 3 new commissioners today. He'll pick a leader of the Department of Education, the State Office of Higher Education, and the Corrections Department. We'll have more on that tomorrow. After 8 years as governor, Mark Dayton is leaving office in a couple weeks. His 2 terms have sometimes been rocky, and they've taken a toll on his health. But he's also racked up significant accomplishments. Brianna Biersbach has this look back at Dayton's years as governor.
This isn't exactly how Mark Dayton pictured he'd go out. He wanted to spend his final weeks traveling the state to visit projects he worked on as governor. Instead, he spent 40 days hooked up to an oxygen tank at Mayo Clinic in Rochester due to complications from spinal surgery. It's a frustrating situation for Dayton, but it's not exactly unusual. As the state's economic outlook improved over the last 8 years, the 71-year-old governor's health deteriorated. In 2017, he fainted during his State of the State speech. In vintage Dayton fashion, he responded to his latest health problems with a self-deprecating joke.
When I took office, I was the oldest person ever to become governor of Minnesota, and the previous oldest person died in office. So I'm about 4 weeks away from surpassing that, but I've obviously had my challenges.
Dayton will leave Minnesota with a projected $1.5 billion budget surplus and more than $2 billion in reserves. That's a much improved situation from the projected $6.2 billion budget deficit when he came into office. He pumped an additional $2 billion into education and helped build the new Vikings Stadium. And on a sunny day in May of 2013, Dayton signed a bill on the front steps of the Capitol that made same-sex marriage legal in Minnesota.
What a day for Minnesota.
Yeah. But Dayton often clashed with Republicans. In 2011, he and the Republican-controlled legislature shut down state government for 20 days because they couldn't agree on a budget fix. Republicans opposed his tax increases, and they criticized him for growing state spending. In 2017, their feud peaked when Dayton vetoed funding for the House and the Senate, and the legislature took him to court. Outgoing House Speaker Kurt Dowd clashed with the governor most often.
He is very difficult to work with. I'll point to the fact in this last session, we just bent over backwards to try to get bills in the shape that he wanted. And usually in the last week of session, we will be negotiating with him every day, 4 to 6 hours a day. And this year, in the last week of session, Governor Dayton canceled meetings with us or refused to meet with us 6 times in 7 days.
Dayton has regrets. He anguishes over the technical problems with the MinSure Health Insurance Exchange website and the MinLar system for vehicle registration. He also wishes he could have sold Minnesotans on his push for all-day preschool and his plan to clean up lakes and streams that have been polluted by farm runoff.
I thought if I dramatized it as an issue and tried to do so, people rise up and say, we're not going to stand for this. We want our water to be clean. We insist on it.
Still, a recent NPR News Star Tribune poll shows Dayton leaving office with a majority of Minnesotans approving of the job he's done as governor. His oldest son, Eric, said even if Minnesotans disagreed with him, they thought he was sincere.
I think that transparency, I hear all the time that, people might not like a decision he made, they might not like his position on a certain policy, but they never question where it comes from. They never question his motives. And I think that being that open book for as long as he has, people trust him.
Dayton is proud of his push to increase funding for public education. He's also happy legislators funded all-day kindergarten. He approved billions of dollars of public infrastructure projects, and he notes the jobs created while he was governor. And he's quick to mention the state's healthy financial situation, even though surpluses and budget reserves are largely unseen by the public. In fact, he doesn't expect the public to dwell on most of what he's done as governor.
You don't do it for the political or life obituaries you're going to get or not get. I hope people can come to see that what I did was first of all, it was driven by what I believe was right for Minnesota.
Legacies, Dayton said. Who knows? Brianna Bierschbach, NPR News.
Several conservation groups and Native American tribes have filed suit to try to block the state's recent approval of the proposed Line 3 oil pipeline. Dan Crocker reports.
Last month, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission approved a certificate of need for the pipeline replacement project, ruling that the safety benefits of building a new, larger oil pipeline outweighed allowing the old one to continue to operate. Now, three conservation groups, along with the Red Lake and White Earth bands of Ojibwe, have filed two separate suits at the Minnesota Court of Appeals to try to overturn that decision. The PUC approved the pipeline despite opposition from the Minnesota Department of Commerce, which argued the state doesn't need it. And Friends of the Headwaters attorney Scott Strand says that's worth paying attention to.
The Department of Commerce and the PUC are usually in sync, and when they're not, that's again sets off a bell that suggests that maybe something has gone awry here.
Additional lawsuits have also been filed challenging the state's environmental study of the pipeline project. Enbridge plans to begin construction on Line 3 early next year and have it in service by the end of 2019. Dan Crocker, NPR News, Duluth.
A bipartisan criminal justice bill in Washington is headed for approval. Under the proposed law, several thousand federal inmates convicted of nonviolent offenses could have their sentences reevaluated. But as Brant Williams reports, people who support reducing the incarceration rate in Minnesota say changes to state law will have the most impact.
Some view the so-called First Step Act, passed by the U.S. Senate, as an opening move towards reducing the country's prison population. The law would affect a relatively small portion of people in the prison system. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 87% of U.S. inmates are housed in state prisons.
Most of the reform that's going to make changes here and have an impact will be at the state level.
Ron Latz is a DFL senator from St. Louis Park and the ranking minority member of the Senate Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety Finance and Policy.
You know, a couple of years ago, we passed a significant drug reform bill with the goal of reducing the number of nonviolent and lower-level drug cases that end up in prison.
Latz is talking about the 2016 Drug Sentencing Reform Act, a Minnesota law which passed with bipartisan support. It made a number of changes, including adding a new gross misdemeanor category for some first-time offenders. However, a report issued in January by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission said that, at the time, the anticipated drop in demand for prison beds had not yet been materialized. One aim of the criminal justice reform movement is to try and keep some people out of the system altogether. So advocates have turned their attention to prosecutors and the courts because they both play a central role in determining who goes to jail and who doesn't. During his unsuccessful campaign to become the Hennepin County Attorney, Mark Hazy ran on a platform that called for significant changes to the cash bail system. He says studies show that people who can't make bail and stay locked up before trial are more likely to plead guilty. Hazy says that's often because they just want to be able to get out and be with their families.
And another thing that research has shown is that people who are held pretrial are more likely to reoffend later.
Hazy adds that people often lose their jobs or housing after being locked up and may have a hard time finding legal ways to make a living. Hazy says policies like these contribute to the racial disparities which exist in Minnesota prisons. According to the most recent data from the State Department of Corrections, Native Americans are less than 2% of the population, but make up nearly 10% of the people in Minnesota prisons. African Americans make up 35% of the state prison population, though they make up less than 7% of people who live here. Brian Fullman went to prison in 1992 in Illinois as a young adult. He grew up on the south side of Chicago and sold drugs as a teenager. While Fullman served a 2-year sentence, he realized that he wasn't learning anything in there that would keep him from coming back. And he says Minnesota policymakers need to learn that a sentence needs to include quality time, not just quantity.
You have to stop with this idea that if I give them more time, then they'll get it. If I put them in a jail cell longer, then maybe they'll find clarity inside of that box. That's the first thing you have to abandon.
Fulman works with Isaiah, a faith-based advocacy group seeking to make fundamental changes in the justice system. He and others testified last week at a meeting of the state's Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Fulman says he went to the meeting to show commissioners that rehabilitation is possible.
I was there to be an example of the potential of change. I was there to let them know what I used to be and what I am now, and that it can happen.
Fulman and others oppose a proposed change to the state guidelines, which could extend sentences for some repeat offenders. The commission will also consider other changes to criminal history scores, which could result in shorter sentences when it meets later today. Brant Williams, NPR News.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.